The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to learn why West African architects look to the past to beat future heat. Writer Peter Schwartzstein tells us about an ongoing debate over whether to return to mud-made homes. His article, Made from Mud, appeared in the February 2023 issue of National Geographic. It includes photographs taken by Moise Saman. A caption from one of the photos reads, "The mud brick walls of the 19th century Grand Mosque, of Bobo Dioulasso in Burkina Faso are waterproofed every year with shea butter, but mud often can't hold up to the intense rains climate change brings." Now let's learn more as we go to the main story. On a mid-May morning in the village of Koumé, Burkina Faso, Sanan Musa has nearly finished annual maintenance on his three-room house. He replaced termite-ridden roof supports with freshly cut beams and reinforced the heat-defying mud walls, some of which are a yard thick and more than 100 years old. After replenishing the roof thatch and sacrificing the goat to the memory of his ancestors, all that remains is applying layers of rainproofing to the exterior. "The mud will keep us cool. The motor oil, clay, and cow dung will keep us dry," Musa says as we tour his living space, which is a good 25 degrees cooler than outside. "We've perfected this," he says. Musa, a 50-something retired school librarian with a somber demeanor, is proud of his house. That doesn't mean living in it is his first choice, though. In recent years, he's watched his wealthier neighbors in this verdant strip of the country's southwest rebuild their homes in concrete. He has smarted at what he sees as a symbol of his relative poverty. Despite his considerable debt and consecutive failed harvest of the crops he relies on to pad his pension, status and safety are tempting him to borrow money and abandon his mud home. When we met, two brothers in the village had recently been killed in their sleep when a mud wall collapsed on them. Inside a crumbling mud meeting house, Musa sits to the side of the village chief, Sanu, who goes only by one name, is furious. He has mandated mud construction in the village center in a bid to preserve the old ways, but fewer and fewer residents are following his instructions, including his own sons. "This is our heritage," Sanu says. "For thousands of years, these houses gave us a good life. Why would we change when we most need them?" "I guess this is modernity," he adds. "Maybe we can't fight it anymore." Mud versus concrete. Across Africa's Sahel region, there are thousands of villages like Koumé, and in the dozens I've visited in several countries, the use of concrete is increasing. As living standards rise and access to concrete expands, some of the world's hottest, poorest landscapes are rapidly morphing from brown to cinder block gray. But abandoning traditional materials and the construction techniques that underpin their uses is anything but a sign of progress, or so says a growing coterie of architects, community leaders, and government officials. Particularly not now, when climate change is making already hot regions even hotter, and concrete is fueling some of that warming. The manufacture of cement, a key ingredient of concrete, accounts for around 8% of global carbon dioxide emissions. Proponents of traditional building techniques are adamant that climate-battered communities need more, not fewer, homes, schools, and civic buildings made in the traditional way. "The reality is that cement construction is simply sexy," says Francis Carey, a Burkina Faso born architect and globally renowned advocate of eco-sensitive architecture. "But it's bad sex. It is not a producing comfort," he says. Mud walls, when built thick enough, can absorb and store a lot of heat, which then dissipates as outside temperatures cool in the evening. By contrast, thin concrete cinder blocks with their hollow recesses allow heat to pass through freely, rapidly warming interiors. Architects like Carey are motivated in part by a desire to preserve heritage and identity. For all Mudd's recent association with poverty and backwardness, bricks made from the material can produce spectacular, globally significant architecture such as Timbuktu's city center in Mali and Burkina Faso's Grand Mosque of Bobo Dioulasso. Countries with impressive but largely lost tradition of mud construction, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, are also trying to replicate the aesthetics and cooling features of traditional architecture, incorporating wind tunnels, building orientation, and the use of shade. They appear less interested in the construction materials that were once used. Our forefathers built things with whatever they had, and maybe if they had had a certain type of modern composite panel 500 years ago, they'd have used it, says Chris Wan, head of design management at Masdar, a pioneering sustainably-oriented city in Abu Dhabi. It's about adopting traditional materials, traditional designs. We also build whatever's best within our means, he said. But mud brick revivalists have a grander ambition as well, particularly in Africa. On a continent that accounts for just 4% of global emissions, yet is suffering much of the worst climate-related fallout, they're trying to assume ownership of some of the solutions, even as world powers struggle to take meaningful action. In beating the heat, these architects suggest homegrown, nature-based traditions could be every bit as important as foreign technology and expertise. We have chosen artifice. We have chosen to detach ourselves from our origins, says Salima Naji. An award-winning architect, Naji champions mud construction in Morocco, which has aggressively turned its back on the material in recent decades, even though the country boasts one of the richest collections of earth and earth architecture in the world. We have done this because we have forgotten the extraordinary benefits of these buildings in the heat. But we must remember because we need it now more than ever, Naji says. A refuge for the sweaty. Crisscrossing Burkina Faso by car provides an illustration of mud's many perks. It's at least 113 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade by the time I arrive in the northern town of Kaya, but well under 86 degrees inside architect Clara Sawadogo's latest design. The vaulted earth ceiling and stone mud walls of the half-finished clinic cocoon, the Cool, angled toward the prevailing north winds and surrounded by lush, shady greenery, the site is already enticing enough for dozing stray dogs. Sawadogo is young, environmentally savvy, and part of a global movement to repopularize mud. She's got plenty of talking points. The material is essentially free, or at least locally available, for a fraction of the cost of concrete, which requires several ingredients that in Burkina Faso's case are mostly imported. At the adobe pits that dot the outskirts of many of the larger villages, teams of laborers lever mud from the ground, compress it into rectangular cookie-cutter-like fittings, then sell each air-dried brick for 40 West African francs. That's about 10 cents U.S. People tell me it's the 21st century. Stop using mud, Sawadogo says, gesturing to the clinic. But look at this. What's not modern about this? Mud construction contributes little to global warming, and concrete tends to be a gateway once people can afford it to another fossil fuel-guzzling invention, air conditioning. Worldwide, both the electricity and the coolants required by air conditioning are growing resources of greenhouse gas emissions. The greatest selling point of mud in Burkina Faso, where temperatures seldom dip much below 90 degrees, is that it makes the heat tolerable even without air conditioning. Most of Africa is on track for more than 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by late this century, a figure that masks even more dramatic temperature increases in parts of the continent. In Boromo, roughly a three-hour drive southwest of the capital of Ouagadougou, Ibodu Abala has recently rebuilt his part-concrete sheet-metal roofed house entirely in mud. I can't tell you what a joy it is to be able to spend time inside the house now without suffering, he says. The Nubian Vault Association, an international NGO, helped construct the home, one of more than 600 private houses it built in Burkina Faso in 2020. The organization's vaulted model requires neither metal roofs, which magnify heat in both concrete and mud houses, nor wood. That's vital in a country losing up to 600,000 acres of woodland a year to deforestation, according to forestry officials, some of it for roof supports. In the royal court of Tib, a commune along the Ghanaian border where most residents have long since turned to concrete, some appear to regret ever having abandoned their mud homes. They see the comfort that they said no to before, says Baya Dariana Abdu, a farmer who lives inside the local chief's mud-only compound and has witnessed clandestine nocturnal returns to the exiles' crumbling old houses. They're sneaking back. Doctors in four medical facilities I visited report a roughly fivefold increase in their heat-related admissions and deaths over the past decade. Some of them suspect that a disproportionate number of these patients rebuilt in concrete but lack the means to artificially cool their new houses. On a sizzling hot day in midsummer, the town of Leo is still, except for the local clinic. Rambunctious children chase one another among its shaded courtyards. Their parents rest beneath the surrounding trees. Even newly arrived patients, among them a man who's just been pried from a car wreck, marvel at the naturally cool wards. Francis Carey, a designer of the buildings, is pleased but not surprised at the effect. We've learned that it's not just about materials. It's not about concrete necessarily being bad, he says. It's what you do with them. This is what it can look like when you spend the time to make a proper clay structure. Big names, near and far, seem convinced by his reasoning. In recent years, Carey has designed a new National Assembly building in Benin that's nearly complete. A symbol for the nation, he says, modeled on a palaver tree. Another one he created for Burkina Faso has yet to get off the ground. In March 2022, he became the first African architect to win the Pritzker Prize, the most prestigious award in architecture. Dangerous to live in. Mud brick buildings, for all their seemingly magical cooling powers, have at least one major drawback. Until the late 1990s, the historic Ksar, or fortified village, Abunau, in southern Morocco, trilled with the sound of more than 100 families, but its rammed earth walls began to collapse, and a falling gatehouse badly injured a teenage boy, shaking residents' faith in the Ksar's structural integrity. Tales of even worse disasters elsewhere, some fatal, reinforced that fear. Gradually, Linganai Bil Aid and his family found themselves almost alone. Now, without their critical mass of residents needed to maintain the historical crenellated defenses, the Ksar is crumbling at record pace, becoming an even riskier habitat. People are scared, and you can understand why, says Bilait, an agricultural laborer who earns extra income, roping together palm frond fences to keep encroaching desert sands at bay. Sometimes the walls just fall down. You could die. In one of the climate change's most bitter ironies, in the same warming that has bolstered mud's importance against heat, it's also triggering more extreme weather events which imperil mud structures. Despite frequently resurfacing his home as exterior walls, Bil Ayit says the downpours these days are far too strong to keep the interior dry, no matter how much protective layering he adds. He, too, is thinking of relocating. In Teyoule, in the Atlas Mountains between Benau and the Sahara and Marrakesh, those fiercer rains have combined with the impact of centuries of deforestation to fuel devastating flash floods through the denuded valleys. Most years, at least a few locals die. Those who remain have noted that it's concrete houses, not those made of traditional mixed mud and stone, that appear to weather the torrents. Some of the abandonment of traditional materials may simply be a function of changing taste. In his lush, beautifully maintained garden in Marrakesh's leafy north periphery, Mohamed Amin Kabbage, one of the country's leading architects, regrets some of the aesthetic changes that have come with the exodus. But he says it's only natural that people would favor concrete. Most traditional mud structures permit only small windows that let in minimal light, and most of them require regular maintenance of the kind that time-pressed or leisure-seeking families prefer to avoid. These kinds of designs might be exotic if you come from London or Paris for 1 or 2 days, he says, but if you're given a choice, you'll prefer to live somewhere else. As much of Morocco has shifted from communal to more individualistic lifestyles, and as incomes have increased enough for people to afford AC, mud houses and their reliance on the collective to maintain and often build them do appear increasingly out of step with modernity. Deeper environmental and economic forces, though, frequently have little choice. In the countryside, drought and desertification are hobbling agriculture, and, or desertification, I should say, the dominant rural profession. The loss of viable livelihoods is driving people into the cities. Some villages have lost up to half their inhabitants to urban areas in recent years. It's all contributing to a situation where many fearful and displaced villagers have also ended up unhappily living in concrete. You need to understand how much I miss the cool of my old house. Few of us wanted this, says Dries Matawi, who immigrated from a mountain village to an impoverished Marrakesh neighborhood 30 years ago. But life demanded that I move to the city, and city life is not good for mud. Urbanization presents a particular challenge for proponents of traditional materials and building techniques. Although mud has historically been deployed in dense urban settings, as with Yemen's centuries-old skyscrapers, architects fear for its place in cities of the sort that are swelling across Africa. The helter-skelter, unplanned nature of those booming metropolises doesn't always allow for the effective use of wind direction, airflow, and other natural cooling devices. For their part, insurance companies and municipalities remain unconvinced of mud safety, so they frequently legislate against its use. Even obtaining traditional materials in urban settings can be surprisingly tricky. Where are you going to get mud to build at a scale close to here, says Kabbage, who has to go kilometers away. Assailed by some of the most debilitating heat at their Sahelian neighbors to the south, and with air conditioning still beyond many people's means, the likes of Salima Naji aren't admitting defeat yet. She has noticed more interest in mud architecture among villages across Morocco. Many of them grasp its tourism potential. Naji and her peers highlight the strong environmental imperative to rein in, or at least reform, concrete production in Morocco, where developers have robbed entire beaches of sand for use in construction. Elsewhere, in countries like Vietnam and Bangladesh, developers source much of their sand from riverbeds, which fuel soil subsidence and more intense erosion and flooding. But reviving a tradition when it's already lost its grip on the public imagination is a formidable task. People have grown accustomed to building houses as and when their finances allow, something that mud construction, fragile until completion, doesn't permit. In some places, concrete access has expanded so dramatically and knowledge of mud has dropped so precipitously that most more modern material may be cheaper. Most important, climate and other struggles continue to eviscerate the social and natural environment in which this kind of construction was embedded. And that could be the key. Can traditional architecture thrive when so much that buttressed it can't? This is all connected to society. You cannot disconnect it from everything that is going on around us, Naji acknowledges. But still, we push ahead. If you have just 1, 2, 3 of these buildings, it's not enough. We're trying to create a snowball effect to normalize it again. We need people to see this. An uncertain future. Francis Carey is in a reflective mood when I call. Each of the past few rainy seasons has been more destructive than the last, obliterating hundreds of mud brick buildings across Burkina Faso, including a school which collapsed on a classroom of children and part of the celebrated Grand Mosque of Bobo Dioulasso. The subsequent bad press has only reinforced the clamor for concrete, no matter the cost. But Carey's phone is ringing off the hook with requests for work, and he's bullish about Mud's prospects. It's a matter of time. It's a matter of belief. It's a matter of political will. It's a fight, and we're not looking left and right. I just push on it, he says. There's a lot of accumulated knowledge now. In 10 years, you're going to be surprised by our success. Kerry and other MUD advocates have been hard at work trying to rehabilitate the material's image. They're finding ways to protect MUD buildings from downpours by adding broader metal canopy roofs that project more than 3 feet from the walls, for example, or mixing small portions of cement into the MUD bricks to fortify them. Just making MUD bricks more available can help. In an industrial park outside the Burkinabe capital, Mohamedou Zai's workers cut, condense, and sell thousands of standard-size compressed bricks, earth bricks, providing reliable supply and ease of construction to contribute to the success of concrete. "I remember how cool my grandfather's house was," Zai says. "I wanted it to be simpler for others to replicate the experience." Through a rigorous emphasis on not cutting corners with a material that is unforgiving of shouting construction, the MUD architects hope to limit the building collapses that are damning them all by association. At her construction site in Kaya, Clara Sawadogo says she has had to be so exacting in erecting the vaulted roof that 15 of her original 25 masons quit, citing the difficulty of the work. More than anything, though, Kerry wonders if, after being fed a steady diet of half-truths about MUD's dangers and concrete's promise, weary citizens simply need more everyday examples of what well-built MUD architecture can offer. Around Kodogo, 60 miles west of Owadogo, he has tried to create something of a showcase of a secondary school, Lycée Sorge, and at the Burkina Institute of Technology, a technical college. Teachers at the school say that the hundreds of students can concentrate better with the multi-layered and overhanging roofs between compressed earth brick walls and surrounded by floor-to-ceiling windows. To one 18-year-old computer science student who gave his name as Nathaniel and who's never lived in a home with electricity, let alone cooling, it's almost as if these places are air-conditioned. "We were told MUD was bad," he says, "but we were told we needed to work to escape this. But I would be happy to live in something like this." Some interesting things happening there in Africa with MUD homes. Well, next we're going to learn how climate change is changing the way some people feel about flying. We're just going to read an excerpt from this, "The No-Set Jet, They've Given Up Flying to Save the Planet." This is written by Deborah Kamen and appeared in the February 6, 2023 issue of the New York Times. "These days, the skies don't seem so inviting. Airfares are climbing, passengers are fighting, computer systems and entire airlines are melting down." Any of these might be reason enough for some to stay off a plane, but for a small yet growing number of travelers, the problem with air travel goes way farther. They're giving up flying because of its impact on the climate. "I choose to stay grounded because it aligns me with what is true," says Don Castellano, 36, a former teacher, who in 2020 signed a pledge not to travel by air. "The climate is breaking down," he said. "The last 8 years on Earth have been the hottest on record. Sea level rise is accelerating, and extreme weather events are happening more often than ever. Air travel accounts for about 4% of human-induced global warming, and the United Nations warns that airplane emissions are set to triple by 2050. "Planes are becoming more efficient, but our appetite for air travel is outpacing the industry's environmental gains. One Boeing 747, carrying 416 passengers from Heathrow Airport to London to Edinburgh, produces the same carbon dioxide as 336 cars traveling the same distance, according to BBC Science Focus, a peer-reviewed magazine, though such comparisons depend on a wide range of factors like fuel efficiency and even time of day. That jumbo carbon footprint is leading many activists and scientists to issue rallying cries to fly less or not at all. This is a climate emergency," says Peter Kalmus, a climate scientist with the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory who founded No Fly Climate Sci, an online forum on the link between aviation and climate change. "When you get on a plane, not only are you responsible for emissions, but you're also casting a vote to continue expanding the system. trading wings for wheels, Mr. Castriano, who lives in Burlington, Vermont, spent more than a decade as a middle school teacher. He traveled extensively during that time, but has become increasingly concerned about the pace of climate change over the past 5 years. Neither he nor his wife, Laura, has taken a flight since 2019. And in 2021, Mr. Castriano left his classroom job to take on a new role as Chief Content Officer at Subject to Climate, a nonprofit organization that provides climate-related teaching resources. Staying on the ground doesn't mean he stays put. He takes frequent bicycle trips around Vermont. When he travels shorter distances, he drives an all-electric Nissan Leaf. Next month, when a good friend gets married in California, he and his family will take several weeks to make their way across the country by train, a choice that, according to the 2021 U.S. Department of Energy data book, is 34% more energy efficient per passenger than traveling by air. I would love to visit every place on earth, he said, but my mental health would be poor if I were to fly. In 2020, Mr. Castellano signed a pledge at Flight Free USA to not travel on airplanes that year, and he has renewed the pledge annually. His community of fellow signatories is small. Ariella Granite, a co-founder of the site, says 365 people signed on in 2022, and in past years, the number has climbed to nearly 450. Flight Free has a larger presence in Australia and Britain and across Europe. A number of similar organizations are rallying travelers to abandon air travel. Ms. Granite, 46, works as an architect and an interior designer in Berkeley, California. She has been a climate activist for decades, she said, but felt the need for more critical action during California's increasingly ferocious and destructive recent wildfire seasons. Living through that brought the climate urgency deep into my gut, Ms. Granite says. I don't think I'll ever be on a plane again. Like most travelers committed to reducing or eliminating their air travel, she shuns the idea of carbon offsets in which carbon credits can be purchased, even though actions like planting trees in exchange for greenhouse gases admitted. As climate change intensifies, critics say that rather than erasing carbon in the atmosphere, the practice preys on travelers' guilt and offers an excuse to pollute without producing viable results. Many point to the intensifying wildfires in the American West, which have burned down forests planted with carbon offset funds, as a metaphor for the inefficiency of offsets. I actually think it would be better for people to fly without offsets, but be aware of the pollution they're making rather than just thinking, oh, I've solved the problem, Ms. Granite said. Ms. Granite was inspired to start Flight Free USA, she said, after reading a 2019 article in Vox about a group in Sweden that has committed to breaking air travel habit. Airlines are making an effort to fly more sustainably, with pledges to achieve net zero carbon emissions in the next 3 decades and move toward alternative fuels and electric power. Airlines for America, a trade association that lobbies on behalf of airlines, said in a statement that the industry was working with the U.S. government to reduce its footprint, even as the group said U.S. carriers transport over 2 million passengers and more than 65,000 tons of cargo per day, while contributing just 2% of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions. Activists say that progress isn't coming fast enough and are pushing for frequent flyers to at least consider small changes, which they say could add up to a big difference. Mr. Castriano says that if the day comes when vessels like the one used the crossing of one passenger become more available, he would jump aboard. I would love to visit every place on earth and get on a boat and head somewhere else, but right now I'm sort of limited to this continent, he said. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.